Good morning, I'm Katie Thorley and I'm going to introduce Richard Sperry from Herefordshire, who's going to talk to us about outwintering both beef and sheep on his farm over in Herefordshire. So good morning, Richard. Could you give us a bit of an overview of your farm?
Yeah, we farm in just in Herefordshire. We're right on the Welsh border. So we're very much a Welsh farm in England, if that makes sense. And we've got land up to 1,000 feet. And, you know, Hereford's quite an intensive area with a lot of potatoes, biogas, etc. So we sort of end up renting what sort of other people don't want, really. So to expand the business, we've ended up using an outwintering system rather than just have to capitalise and grow sheds on the back of it. We currently run about 1,750 to 1,800 ewes, of which 900 lamb in March inside, which is, you know, existing buildings which I've had for a long time. But they're outwintered on fodder beet until about a fortnight before lambing. And then the second lot are my outdoor lambing flock, which start on the 5th of April to hit grass growth, and they're outwintered on fodder beet until about a fortnight before they start, at which time they then have to go to very, very good grass to lift the protein levels. So I don't want to get too technical on sentence one, but that's the main thing with outwintering, is it's a maintenance ration, especially with fodder beet, as opposed to a sort of protein ration. And we took 2 or 3 years to learn that properly, but you do need to hit that spring grass. So you need to work backwards from that, really. And then we've got 90 spring calving suckler cows, which are outwintered. But I say outwintered from after Christmas. We wean into a shed, give them haylage, etc. And then the second sort of days get longer, basically, is my yardstick. They go out onto anything green because a dry suckler cow will cope with virtually anything. And they're calved out. So we finish a fair few cattle, but they stay out the system. But obviously, with a lot of maize grown, etc., we've got a good break in the autumn to grow an awful lot of green crop.
Okay, so your finished cattle stay inside, but the rest of your livestock, you try to keep them out wintered majority of the year, apart from lambing for the ewes and the one flock of ewes. And then once you've weaned, you get those cows back outside as soon as you can.
We sure do, yes. It's any cow with a calf at foot, no matter who gets obsessed with what breed, nearly makes money with the calf sucking. But it's clamping down that dry period that really eats into the money. So we've obviously got an awful lot of sheep in the spring on grass. Well, that's my first cut silage. It's already gone into the stock. And, you know, I've got neighbours, etc., that they are obsessed with making silage. But losing your best value April, May grass just to make bales for some dry cows in the winter, to me, just doesn't stack up. The second you can get them out your hair, you've saved about £1 a day on their costs. So it's really essential to me with the cows, else they couldn't be here.
So what was it that made you decide to outwinter? You know, what made you switch to that? Or have you always done it?
Well, mainly I came home from Harper in 1999. I had a nice traditional family farm of about 280 acres, but very little had been spent on buildings, etc., as in very little. We could only house about 80 cattle. And as I expanded, we needed to sort of expand without too much capital, because we'd got a big mortgage, we'd got rented stuff. So I sort of played with the system since then, mainly because I couldn't afford the buildings for the amount of stock I got. And that's no different to an awful lot of people now, I don't think. So we're on reasonably sandy clay loam with sandstone underneath, and we burn heavily in the summer. So I thought we'd turn it on its head, and if we burn in the summer, let's have the advantage of that ground in the winter. But when subsidy was on cows, which is a long time ago now, I don't know if people all remember it, but we got up to 220 cows and we were out wintering most of those. And then as I started to make a little bit more money, we built sheds for them. And I sort of forgot for 5 or 6 years what actually worked and how we got there. So we've sort of gone back to it very much now. And I had a neighbour rang me this morning, straw sales up to £120 an acre last night. Nothing is going to be driving my outdoor suckler cow system any more than the prohibitive cost of that.
Where did you get started? How did you start? Did you visit other farms or get consultants, or just where did you, if somebody else wanted to get started, where would you point them?
Oh, that's a good one. I went shearing New Zealand a couple of times, 1999, 2000. I didn't actually look at farms as such. I was a little bit more head down and wanted the money. But you could sort of see that you go to a farm and think, where's the buildings? So that set me off thinking, is it doable? And, you know, we've had grief over the years because a bunch of sucker cows out wintered in February, if it's lashing sideways of rain, do not look pretty. But as long as you're going to put that ground into something useful after, it works. But my advice to anyone wanting to get started is, rather than go to 8 or 10 different places or read too much, pick someone or, you know, one of the guys on a webinar or something that have made it work, and just collar them, because sometimes the more you ask, the more you get told. And I know everyone needs knowledge, but there's some tremendously successful people out there doing it and have been for like 10, 12, 15 years. I'd just say sort of collar one of those and give them a phone call. You know, if anyone wanted to do it and they rang me, as long as I can talk on the run, or if they want to come and see us like they did with the Fodder Beat open day, you know, more than welcome.
Okay, so how do you select your fields? I think you just mentioned that if you're going to put a different crop into them, you select them like that. Is that always how you select which field you're going to use?
Part of it's rotation, and then, you know, it's not every field on the farm I can use. We haven't got a blank canvas of. But if it's steep, put sheep on it, because obviously cattle on steep land, no matter how careful you are, will move the soil downhill. It's sort of, I think it's called solifluction, but soil needs to move downhill anyway, as in naturally, where sheep tend to pad the surface and then they don't move the actual topsoil. So if it's cattle, even if you've got a grassy bank and then a flat bit, if you just put, say, 50% of the field into fodder beet, all I tend to do is use my temporary grass from here before and have the run back as part of the same field, as opposed to run back. And then if you've got a dry 10 days or a fortnight, you can honestly just move the fence across the fodder crop or the beet and keep the run back held back because it's dry. And then if you do have a really extreme wet weather event, which we're getting more of, it doesn't matter then if you suddenly move the electric fence the other way and give them an acre of run back in one hit, so they got someone to lie. So everyone gets obsessed with having drum straight electric fence lines and it all looks lovely. But yeah, I tend to use the weather to what they get. So if you've got a bit of grown back grass, just save it till it's wet and then don't let them have it. Because as long as the cow's full in particular and they can lie down, they're more than happy. But so I am experimenting.
You have to be flexible.
Very, very. Yeah, that's the trick. I mean, when I started, I thought the fence line had to be moved X amount, X days, drum straight, virtually. But that's nearly the opposite. Like I say, if you've got a dry 10 days, just let them have forage and keep the run back clean. Especially after Christmas, because you get the more drying days and it will sort of open up. But one thing I've done this year, because I'm going to look at putting dairy cross bullocks onto fodder beet just in the autumn when we're very tightly stocked and a lot of cattle are coming in. And we've undersown some maize. So I've got two fields of half maize, half fodder beet. And then when the maize comes off, we've undersown it. So hopefully the maize stalks and the root structure and the ryegrass in the bottom of that will be the run back. So even basically 2 days after the maize is cut, which will be early October at the latest, we will have forage crops that we can graze with run back already grown. So that's something I'm playing with and I will report back, I promise.
Mm-hmm. Good. And how do you choose which crops you're actually going to choose to grow?
In the autumn, we sort of have a little whirlwind of what we've got to spare. So, you know, if you've got big arable acreages, double turnips are still the best, because there's not massive yield, but you can give the cattle an acre a day or whatever. So low crop volume and big runs is the easiest way not to tread it, because that's the hardest thing with fodder beet for sure, is you can grow such a massive weight of fodder in a field that some people's land won't stick the stocking rate to actually to graze it. In February, say this year, it dried up slightly, and then we had over 100 ewes an acre on some fodder beet just to get on top of it, and we still failed to graze it off before they needed to go in. So sometimes small and light for a starter is a lot safer than massive crops and heavy. So
and I guess the yield varies between the different crops quite a bit.
Yeah, I've been playing with it for 15 years plus, I suppose. But like fodder beet per acre is phenomenal stocking rate, but it's not for the faint-hearted. So you need so many animals per acre to actually eat the dry matter. Whereas if you want to start, even some of these cover crops are amazing because they grow an awful lot of green. And, you know, sheep in particular, as long as they've got green across a big area, they don't need huge amounts of it. It depends where you are in the country, really. And at the Welsh border, we're heavily stocked, but it's wetter. But, you know, the further east you go, it's better give them 2-3 acres a day of not much, because you don't have poaching problems, you don't have treading, and you don't have stocking rate issues.
And do you have many issues with pests? Or do you have to protect the crops much?
Turnips traditionally have been the cheapest thing ever, but they're getting harder and harder to grow because I'm imagining a lot of people are following what flea beetle, etc. is doing to oilseed rape in the UK. And obviously a stubble turnip isn't too different to family. So our stubble turnips are getting harder and harder to grow. We sometimes are spraying for fly. And then if you put them in cheaply, it's fine. And we just pop them in with a front cultivator and little turnip seeds in on the back. But volunteers are getting harder to control and they're not cheap. That's the stubble turnip problem. And the dream crop for yield per acre is obviously fodder beet, but it's very much an arable farmer's crop. And fat hen this year has been an absolute nightmare. So it's four chemical applications for fat hen. So I'm not trying to put anyone off, but it's not for the faint-hearted if you haven't grown many arable crops before. So an awful lot of stock farmers aren't necessarily arable farmers. So I'd suggest if you want to start with something, try and grow a fast-growing forage rape, cross kale with maybe some big butt turnips in the bottom, put in the next month or so, and hopefully they'll outgrow all the grief you've got and see if it works you that way to start with. And then you can tweak the system after that.
And how do you work? Do you do feed budgeting to work out, you know, what you need for both your cattle and your sheep over that period of time? I know you said you use different amounts depending on, and you're flexible depending on the weather, etc. Yeah. How do you budget what you're going to need each winter?
I grow a specifically soft fodder beet for the sheep that we can graze, and definitely it's outlined to graze. Especially, I mean, some of the land we got fodder beet on this year is quite kiwi. I mean, yeah, we have to spray it downhill and sideland, but it's very much that's what the ewes are going to have. But instead of really strictly blocking it, what we tend to do is let the finishing lambs over it first just to take the tops off, and that's the real rocket fuel. And then we put the in-lamb ewes on after. And then when they've had enough or it looks like, you know, it's getting jaded or bored with his beak left, you can then use singles probably after the twins, or I run 200 dry hogs, which is an absolute dream because they can go and hoover everything up. So I tend to allow the most important stock, the best of it, because when we talk feed budgeting, I don't know, an awful lot of people with, say, dry suckler cows don't even analyze their silage. So they don't really feed budget. Whereas if you've got a field of green crop that's, say, 250 meters long and you know it's got to do 125 days, it's actually easier to just pace it and make sure that the stock are happy, because feed budgeting is good, but it puts some people off to start with, I think. People I've spoke to around here, it does. Well, once you've done it for a year and see if it actually works on the farm, you can then come down to your dry matter readings and do it really what I call properly. But I'd say to anyone just thinking, shall I try it, shan't I? Don't be put off by the science. Just see if it works on your soil type and whether you actually like doing it. Because some people love moving an electric fence a day, and to some people, they'd rather see the cattle all on straw. But it does work. It definitely works. You know, we got a fair bit of ground and not much capital, so it's out there.
And have you got any tips for people on setting up fences and the water, you know, making sure there's water available and et cetera? What have you done to make life easier in that respect?
Well, we've spent a fair bit on tanks and things, but I know cell grazing, etc., is incredibly popular at the moment, but some people, that's a sort of step too far to start with. So having the movable tanks and things, not necessarily. What I try and do is if I've got a field that I know is dry and the tank is on the top end, is move the fence downhill. So obviously the cattle have got access to water all the time. And suckler cows in particular on fodder beet drink hardly anything because they're obviously eating a big, wet, juicy crop in the middle of winter. They're happy, but I occasionally back fence if we have to, but I'm very, very lucky because an awful lot of what we're winter cropping is then subsequently cultivated in the spring, mainly for maize, which needs deep cultivations, and it's already been sort of 50% buck. And we grow 90 acres of maize, so I've got to have 90 acres of winter cover anyway. Whereas, you know, if you're taking productive grassland out to grow a winter crop, obviously you probably want it back in grass quite swiftly in the spring. So it's more important then to stop your poaching as much and maybe bring a back fence down. But all I'd say is there's a huge amount of work that's been done on it. But I just honestly say that don't overcomplicate it and just try one field. I got a friend who said my land's too heavy for putting things on. He put 8 acres of turnips in. End of March this year, the weather suddenly come dry. He put his 22 cows out on 8 acres of turnips, and that kept him out of his hair till nearly May, when his grass took off and he cured some of his poaching. And he thought it was brilliant. So, you know, you haven't got to be completely obsessed with wintering from November to April and working out every day. You know, if you've got a crop in, you can be a little bit of opportunist on year one and see if it works for you, and then build up what works for your farm. Because we're all trying to obviously give everyone all the advice, but a lot of farms are different.
And what problems have you encountered, or what do you do differently now to when you first started 10 or so years ago?
I very much try and, like I said earlier, leave the run back in the field. So don't get obsessed with having a mint crop across the entire field. You can have 2/3 of the field in beautiful crop and 1/3 in old lay and graze it across that boundary. That is perfect for cattle in particular. They love it because they can obviously got fresh lie ground every day and things. And then they've also got an awful lot of crop. So fence it across your drill lines. It's nice to fence down the drill lines. If you fence across and leave some of the old stuff, you've obviously got the root structure underneath it. Let it just grow up. If you planted kale this week, leave the grass you've sprayed out. Don't spray it off. Just let it grow. Because that's obviously deferred grazing as well. They don't just lie on it. And keep everything in-house in a little package of field and try and do it that way. Because run back will sometimes ruin gateways. And, you know, when it comes wet, it's not always nice. And like I say, when it's dry, let them have lots of crop. And when it's wet, let them have lots of run back. And then if you are obsessed with a straight fence line, the day it dries up in March, straighten your fence then. So, but I do try and move every day. Not try, we do move every day. With sheep, you can give them blocks, but cattle or dry cows in particular, even a meter a day when it's wet and they've got something fresh, so they're less likely to break your fence line. And they see you, they know that when you fence, you know, it's feed time. It's just like when you start the tractor and feed them a bale of silage. They don't need top-notch feed all day. If they've hoovered up the green crop 2 hours, well, fine. That's like their concentrate kick. The people who are new to it, a lot of people say, well, they haven't got food all day, but they have, because they obviously need their roughage of some sort. But even that now, I use sort of haylage or oat straw, and I roll that out in front of the fence line so they can graze it under the fence so we don't have to have feeders or any kit in the field.
And you move that out when you need another bale, sort of thing. You don't leave those bales out in the field ready.
Yeah, very much. In the autumn, I try and stash those. This year is going to be difficult because, like I say, straw sales took off last night at a rocket pace. And I do think straw might actually be an awful lot dearer than some of the second-rate grass we're hoovering up. I'm lucky I'm sort of 16 stone and I can still do it. I leave bales on their end and then take the net off. And then I roll them in front of the fence line. I'll post some pictures in the autumn, actually, but you'll be amazed how cleanly they eat, as long as they can't get on top of it. But obviously the ring feeder is the dream, but an awful lot of people get put off with having to sort of lift those and roll them around when it's wet and things. But leaving the bales in the field wrapped is the dream, obviously, but we're already into July. If people are thinking of doing it this autumn, that sort of planning needs doing a year in advance. So, you know, if you want to do that, you've got to be thinking of next spring already, really.
Yeah, and I guess the way you do it, you're obviously not having to take machinery there to be moving bales, and that would obviously cause more poaching.
Yeah, I got people say, oh, I'm out wintering, and sorry, but booming a boom out over a hedge and dropping some bales in a feeder isn't out wintering. You know, it's not how it ought to be. You know, I got a farm up the road with, when we're lambing, last year I had like 600 sheep on roots and 90 suckler cows, and all I had to do was take the old truck up there, pull up and go and walk across fields. You know, I didn't bring a loader tractor up here for over 3 weeks, which when you look at, you know, our loader tractor depreciates at £11 an hour and they don't run around for free. You know, it was very nice, actually. Even in, like, everyone's obsessed with feeding in the morning, but I'd sort of clear the lambing decks and come up here for an hour in the afternoon. And it was quite sort of liberating. You've got headspace. Moving a fence isn't overly onerous, to be honest. You've got time to use the phone. You can look at how the stock looks as you walk back down the fence line. Yeah, so as long as you can sort of keep the kit out, it's good. Like I say, if you've got big areas, say, you know, more out east and people are growing more and more cover crops, you know, that is the dream, because you don't need ridiculous yields, but you've got feed.
And how did you cope with the wet weather last winter? Did that make you have to change things at all?
we ended up with the sheep in particular not even doing any fencing. It sounds a little bit, but like we were pinning sheep back on mud virtually with the fodder beat, and they were not happy at all. And I know it's not ideal, but in the end we thought this is silly because these ewes are lambing in a month. They really need to have some TLC. So we just lift the fences and let them have the cream of it. And I'm very lucky we got suckler cows as well as sheep, but we put either dry hogs up behind what they left, which wasn't that much, or you can run the cows up behind them as it dries up. So we actually abandoned a lot of the principles and just let the sheep cherry pick what they wanted. So it was a bit extreme, and I wouldn't advise it every time, but you know, rather than stick to very, very rigid blocks, if it's wet, just maybe fence a quarter of the field or half, rather than be too strict. And like I say, use your common sense a bit. And everyone who farms stock knows when the stock aren't happy, or suddenly, if they are happy and full, you'd be surprised how little actual supplementary forage they need when they're on an awful lot of forage crop. They just need a bit just to keep them bound up.
And but what sort of impact do you think outwintering's had on your financials of your farm?
Well, I wouldn't. It's pretty simple. I would not be able to farm the amount of stock we got without it. You know, perhaps, you know, people might say we've got too much, but we've got quite a few commitments and it works where we are and things. Like we physically, even if I had £100,000 spare, I would not be building a new sheep shed. But, you know, a lot of it's rented. Say you've got a 5-year FBT and it's withdrawn from you, which does happen. I'm not the first person who's lost one. If you've got an outwintered system, you can transfer that to another block of ground or you're more flexible. Whereas, you know, if you take on a new tenancy and start capitalizing on buildings and things, that's been our biggest problem. If anything happens to that tenancy or that goes, your whole system grinds to a standstill. So I like the flexibility, really. Or if you, you know, I had some ryegrass last year off a chap with a biodigester. Yeah, it was £50 an acre, but I strip grazed that with some heifers just, and it kept 20 odd cattle out of my hair. Well, you know, that gave me 20 more cattle finishing spaces. So I didn't even know that was occurring till October. I suddenly thought, oh, we'll pop a fence up there. And it just gives you flexibility. But you do need to be the sort of person that can bounce off that, you know, because obviously breeding farms don't alter their stock numbers all the time. But I'd say, you know, if you've got a stack of haylage there, fine. And, you know, be honest, if you end up with 100 odd bales of haylage left because you've gotten your turnips a month sooner, you know, it's not the world's biggest problem. I know that it's obviously a cost, but now we've hit a drier spell, you know, it just gives you a little buffer for this time of year. So, yeah, it's keeping an open mind is the main thing.
Okay, and do you have to do anything different to comply with the red tractor standards without wintering?
So as long as you've sort of read the outwintering guidelines that have been put out there, it's pretty good. I mean, obviously, cattle need to have access to water, access to being dry and happy. Well, any outwintering system won't work unless they are, because if you've got a load of cattle stood in the mud, being very grumpy on a very wet November day, it's not doing them any good either. So, no, as long as you just use your common sense, it's fine. And, you know, whenever I have a fabul inspection, I say, yes, the cows go out at Christmas, etc. And, you know, your stock tell you whether the system's working. Like, just react to it quickly. And if, you know, if they're not looking fit enough, you know, up your feed rate and things. But I always find putting cows out after Christmas, you know, whatever, that you have got the best quality grass of the whole year, only 3 months around the corner. So you're not far off spring grass, no matter what you do. So if you've got some cattle you know need a lift, well, they can be prioritized on what looks the best sort of turnout grass.
Thanks, Rich. I think that's great advice. And so for anybody considering it, what would be your top tips for someone that is considering? I know you've said various things as we've gone through, but if you could give your final top tips, that would be great.
Top tips is not be over-obsessed with making it work the first time. Some people are just like, oh, this has got to happen and are too rigid. If you hit last winter, I don't care how good you are at it. If you've not outwintered before, it's seriously hard work and you won't like it. So don't be afraid to open the door and shove them back in somewhere. But once it dries, you'd be surprised how quickly that crop is usable again. So yeah, just keep flexible. And I had a friend once rang me in November and he said, Rich, I want to cut my winter feed bills. Can I come and look at your place? And I said, what, now? And he said, yeah. And I said, well, you're 6 months too late. So start thinking now and just prioritize. You know, try some in-calf heifer, something light. You know, don't go into it wholeheartedly on day one. If you've got dry sucklers, yes. But if you've got different classes of stock, you know, just choose the easiest to start with. And if you like it, do it. But like, the systems only work if you want them to. That's the big thing. There's always a way around every problem. But if you're half-heartedly doing it, or on the road, if dad's against it and you want to do it and you've got friction, it's going to be harder to make it work. And yeah, and just ring someone. You know, you can ring me, just say, what would you do here? Or I've got X field. And yeah, roll the dice basically and don't expect sixes every time.
Okay, that's brilliant. Thanks, Rich. So just start small and then build on it, hopefully when it's obviously been positive and worked on your farm. Sounds like your top tips.
Definitely. Yeah, that is the very best summary. Yeah. You can put 20 in calf heifers on 10 acres quite successfully, trust me. It's when you try and you up the stock rates, you get your problems. So, yeah, we'll finish with your advice, I think, there, Katie.
Okay, brilliant. Thanks, Rich. Thank you for your time today. And if you want to know any more about outwintering, you can head to the HDB website at ahdb.org.uk.